I always appreciate it when the host inquires as to the pronunciations of your last name before we come on screen. It helps me quite a bit. Good morning, and this is the Court of Appeals oral argument calendar. We are proceeding by Zoom platform again today, April 14, 2022. Joe Tarand is our marshal today. You'll see him only by the clock that will appear on your screen. Each of you will have 15 minutes to make your case presentation, with an additional 5 minutes being reserved to appellant counsel. Although we're appearing by Zoom, all of the other rules of appellate procedure except the standing requirement do remain in place. Please state your name and introduce yourself before you begin your case presentation. That's for our recording purposes. And likewise, please keep yourself muted unless you were the one talking, just to eliminate background noise. With that said, I will ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Riley, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding. Now calling case number A210990, State of Minnesota versus Norbert Plus DeCruz.
Mr. Grigsby, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Grigsby, and I represent Norbert Pius DeCruz in this matter. Now, in preparation for today, I look back at the brief, and I think that the argument is very complicated as presented. What I'd like to do in the oral argument is reduce it to what I think are just a series of simple declarative sentences. The first argument I make is that the construction of the Crimsex 1 statute is unconstitutional, because it simply has no rational basis in dispensing with the requirement of sexual intent. In other words—
I hate the fact that I'm going to interrupt you, but I am. It's important for us as a reviewing court to determine and consider whether the trial court in fact heard this claim. Issues that are first presented on appeal aren't necessarily addressed. So how do you respond to that? That was an argument raised in the respondent brief.
Sure, that's right. In certain situations, it has to be raised at the district court level because this court exercises appellate jurisdiction. This case, it doesn't present that issue because this is simply a de novo review of a legal construction. There is no factual finding that the district court would have had to have done here with facts. You would have been in the identical position today had it been raised.
If you are raising a constitutional issue, Mr. Grigsby, do you not have to also serve and notify the Attorney General of the claim you're making? And if you agree, did you do that?
They were served when we made the argument, and the argument was in the brief. They're a party to the brief. Typically, the constitutionality of a statute, this issue comes up in civil matters where they're not a party, but they're a party here, and they had an opportunity to weigh in. But there are situations in which the court has to do fact-finding, and that's necessary because this court exercises some deference to the lower court's fact-finding. That is not the case here. The argument is very simple. There is no rational basis to dispense with proof of sexual intent unless you wish to convict people of sex crimes without having any sexual intent.
Is this a claim that you're making that this is a specific intent crime? I mean, I think our case law holds that CSC 1s are general intent crimes, and I'm not seeing what's unconstitutional about the legislature's decision to criminalize this particular conduct as a general intent crime.
I don't think this is a specific or general intent. There simply is no rational basis to convict people of sex crimes without sexual intent. That is the problem.
And when you say without sexual intent, you're saying without specific intent, that the intent must be sexual, right?
Correct. In order to be constitutional, you cannot dispense in a sex crime and have no sexual intent. What it does is it's simply inferring intent from the act of penetration and assuming that in every act of penetration, there is sexual intent, which is true in almost every case, except for the one tiny narrow exception that the bona fide medical exception provides. So That would implicate its constitutionality. My alternative argument.
I have a question for you in follow-up of Judge Frisch. You didn't address Hart, a Supreme Court precedential case that we're bound to follow that indicates that this is a general intent crime. How do we get around the Hart decision in our responsibilities as an intermediate appellate court?
Well, it is a general intent crime as written because it dispenses with the specific intent, I'm saying, salvages its constitutionality. But that lack of intent, that lack of specific intent is a correct construction of the language of the statute. But it doesn't address, and that Hart doesn't deal with the issue that I'm raising squarely, is whether or not it's constitutional to convict people of sex crimes where there isn't any sexual intent.
Does any of that even matter if Judge Freeman, in hearing this trial, did in fact make a finding that appellant acted with sexual intent when he inserted a finger into a private area?
Yes.
She made that finding.
Sure, she did. And I addressed precisely the lack of evidence and sufficiency with respect to that finding. And the truth is, there is not a single fact that she points to that is in addition to the act of penetration. So she has found in the single act of penetration two distinct things. One, there was penetration, and two, there is sexual intent. But she doesn't actually refer to any particular fact besides the penetration on which she makes that finding. That's why there's the claim of sufficiency. And of course, that would be a reading of the statute that is literal, but that doesn't factor in what I've raised as the bona fide medical exception. So that I think that answers the court question, but let me get back to, so that there is no constitutional impediment for the court to do this. This is de novo review. It would have been de novo review because it would have been raised exactly in this posture. There is no deference needed for the trial court, and this court is in an identical position as the trial court would have been to deal with simply what is a logical flaw in the argument of the state here. Secondly, you don't need to decide the constitutionality of this because the bona fide medical exception is a superordinating statute. That means it in the hierarchy is higher, it is superior. Crimsex 1 is a subordinate statute. The bona fide medical exception determines the scope of the application of the criminal sexual conduct. And it says where there is a bona fide medical exception, that statute simply has no application at all.
Mr. Grigsby, did you? I realize, I don't think you were the trial lawyer below. You came in at the post-trial motions, as I read the record. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't think that was raised as a defense before the trial court.
It wasn't because he, for the same reason, the constitutional issue wasn't raised. So what you have in the trial court is actual evidence of the bathing that was taking place and the nature of the event. That should have been, it was the court's responsibility, whether it was raised by the defense to decide the application of any statute. You don't waive sufficiency of the evidence because you were inartful in giving the court a more precise basis. But on review, it seems perfectly clear that this statute was in effect. And for any civilization, it has to acknowledge the difference between two types of touching of the genitals, most of which are illegal, and there's one narrow exception that is illegal. Because if you don't interpret it that way, what do you, have here parents that raise children, and during the course of this, there's going to be some penetration because the standard of penetration, it's a very, very low threshold.
I was hoping I wouldn't be questioning you about this, but you, of course, are making great argument about the medical purpose of any touching that went on. You're not making any claim, or there's no assertion that perhaps I've missed in the briefing or in the trial records that your client had any medical training or any basis for this. how do you rely on the medical, I don't even want to call it a medical protection, medical exception. How can you apply it to this case? What's your best theory on that?
But very simply, the medical exception is the binary of touching. In other words, they're logical complements of one another. Where there is...
Well, I understand that, but how does this apply to your client?
Well, it doesn't require... I thought I made this clear in the brief, that you, under the rule of lenity, that the exception has to be interpreted as broadly as a strict construction would apply to a penal statute, because it is. There is nothing in the statute that intends a licensure, any kind of medical authority. And I have argued that the only way to understand the medical exception is to understand it as the binary of touching genitals illicitly to hurt and touching them for the purpose of not hurting. That is the broad understanding.
I think that we've defined it as having a bona fide medical purpose, which can encompass an array of behaviors. And so I think that there are some parameters around that. I think what Judge Werke is getting at is it's unclear, at least to me, how a parent, a stepfather inserting a finger into a child's vagina and moving it around would ever fall into that category when there's no evidence of any medical purpose for that kind of activity.
Well, there is evidence of a medical purpose, and that's why I spent some time in my brief on the jurisprudence of good faith. Bona fide means good faith. It has nothing, you don't have to be ultimately correct in the how you teach a hygiene regimen to a child.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this child never saw a medical professional in terms of her supposed lack of hygiene. Is there any record evidence that she was visited a doctor or spoke with someone about the hygiene issue that's claimed?
There is nothing in the record, and I doubt that she was ever brought to a medical professional for it. And what I'm suggesting is that if you narrow that bona fide medical exception to require a professional or a licensure, you simply misconstrue it, because there is no limitation or any indication of narrowness that could have easily been put in the statute. And it's not that you have to actually perform an actual, in other words, you can't review and say that wasn't a bona fide medical procedure. He merely has to have the good faith. And if you look at the circumstantial evidence, there is circumstantial evidence. It's brief. It's not accompanied by any preamble. There is no epilogue to it. It is simply during the course of washing. There have, in 25 years, I've never seen this issue even warrant being ripened for consideration.
But let's assume all this is, your argument is correct. The district court, which is the fact finder in this case, made specific findings that the defendant's acts were not committed with a bona fide medical purpose, but instead were committed with sexual intent. It's on paragraph 25.
She says no bona fide medical purpose.
She says defendant's act was committed with sexual or aggressive intent.
Correct. And because she didn't consider the bona fide medical purpose. And I understand, but we're not bound because a judge at a lower court somehow magically intuited something that's not in the record. What fact does she point to? And I think my argument is absolutely clear. She simply inferred it from the act of penetration. There is no other fact that she refers to. And this court's jurisprudence that I comprehensively reviewed agrees with me. This is an isolated matter of touching during the course of bathing of a man who is middle-aged and is standing in the place of his wife because he's retired and she works. So, yes, I know that the fact that the court found that is not sufficient to simply reiterate that at the appellate level. The question is, identify a fact, an addition to the penetration that warrants that finding. Otherwise, you're presuming it from the act of penetration, or worse, you're simply deducing it as being the identical thing. That would... Well,
Mr. Grigsby, are you saying that your client stood in the place of his wife with regard to bathing this 9-year-old girl?
Yes.
And there's no evidence that the wife routinely inserted her finger into the child's vagina to wash it.
That's true, but I don't think that undermines the argument. He's not his wife. That's why there's a good faith requirement that this court has developed well in the case of claim of right. You don't have to be ultimately right in a trespass. There simply has to, the state has to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt the good faith. And that they must do with evidence. We can't just simply say, hey, he did this, this is unusual, there must be sexual intent. There are men who don't understand these procedures. There are men who are not obsessed with sex and don't see a child in the course of bathing as an opportunity. And that is the issue here. Once I talked to this man, I realized this was a narrow exception where he was in disbelief that he was accused of this. So there isn't, if you look at comprehensively all of the cases that you have decided where you have found sexual intent, you have never simply deduced it from the act of penetration itself for good reasons. And the case law is ample. It in many times, it's the sexual intent alone requirement that has saved a conviction from reversal.
Mr. Grigsby, your time has expired, but you will have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before we hear from Mr. Hajdukovic, just want everyone to know, our host does know, I keep getting prompts on my screen telling me that my internet is unstable, and I'm sure it's because of the crazy weather outside. In the event that I would go off screen, I'm going to ask Judge Riley, as the next senior judge, to stop the clock or whatever may need to take place. And with that said, let's hope it doesn't happen. Let's go to respondent counsel.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. The state is asking that this court affirm the appellant's convictions as well as his sentence. And I want to just address a few things that Mr. Grigsby discussed during his
argument. No, I don't want you to do that yet, because I want you to tell the panel, and then you can tell us what you want to address as far as his arguments. But tell the panel, in your opinion, if we can address this constitutional issue that Mr. Grigsby says was adequately raised and that the Attorney General was notified. Do you believe that this is something this court can properly address, or that we should address?
I think that the court could address it. In all candor, my understanding of the Attorney General notification requirement is I believe that it generally applies in civil cases. And as Mr. Grigsby noted, in criminal cases, the Attorney General is served with the brief, so they would be aware of the argument. That said, and of course, the court does have the discretion to review issues not raised below, but this court shouldn't do it in this case. And the reason that I think the single best reason, other than that this is an attack on an extremely important criminal statute that wasn't raised below, is that it frankly doesn't make a difference in the outcome of this case, because there was sexual intent here found by Judge Freeman. So it would really not make sense to declare a statute unconstitutional when what the appellant argues is
are you suggesting that this court address it on its merits?
No, I'm not. Not at all. I'm saying that I think it would in effect be an advisory opinion if you did, because of the fact that it just doesn't change the outcome here. What the appellant argues is constitutionally deficient about the statute, the lack of sexual intent requirement, was found by Judge Freeman. And so this would be, I think, a very poor vehicle to examine that issue, especially given that it wasn't raised below. And that dovetails into what I wanted to address, which was the appellant's argument that the only evidence supporting sexual intent is the act itself. And that is simply belied by Judge Freeman's findings. I'd refer the court to to page 5, which is page 5 also of the appellant's addendum of the verdict and findings. Paragraph 12, Judge Freeman notes several bullet points there supporting her finding of sexual intent. That the victim was 9 years old and didn't need help washing her own body at that point, that the appellant not only put his finger in the victim's vagina, but also didn't remove it immediately, left it there for a short period and moved his finger around, that even if the appellant's wife had instructed him on how to do it, that instruction was apparently just to use a washcloth. The appellant was using his bare hand and bare fingers. And that the appellant only quote unquote assisted with bathing the victim when his wife wasn't home. The appellant has never addressed those findings, has never argued that they are not supported by the record, and they are supported by the record. And so that is additional proof other than the act itself that demonstrates the sufficiency of the evidence in terms of sexual intent. And I think what this court and the Supreme Court have said is that, frankly, in cases weaker than this, in terms of sexual intent, that there was sufficient evidence, and that the act itself, we frequently in criminal law have to infer intent from the act itself. The act itself is strong evidence of intent, and sometimes by itself it may be enough, sometimes it may not be, because every case is different. But in this case, we don't have solely the act itself, and it can't be considered in a vacuum. It has to be considered in light of all the facts and circumstances. And those facts and circumstances here include Judge Freeman's finding that the testimony of the appellant's wife regarding the victim's hygiene issues was not credible. That's on page 7 of the findings, paragraph 25. So we have a specific finding. And again, so that goes into this question of the bona fide medical purpose statute. It wasn't raised below. Counsel phrases it as a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, but even if it is, again, that there's no real reason for this court to address it in any detail, because Judge Freeman did find sexual intent, found that there was essentially no bona fide medical purpose. She didn't use those words specifically, certainly, but the only arguable bona fide medical purpose would be this hygiene issue. And Judge Freeman found the testimony from these defense's only witness on that point to be not credible. She rejected that evidence altogether. So it's not part of the circumstances proved. I think the circumstances proved here, because intent is here as typically based on circumstantial evidence, don't involve any evidence of poor hygiene or any other medical issues that may require attending to. So simply put, there is no basis to claim any sort of bona fide medical purpose to the appellant's actions here. So again, also to kind of echo Mr. Grigsby's argument, I think there is something to the fact that if a person acts with a bona fide medical purpose, they don't have sexual intent. And if a person does have sexual intent, they don't act with a bona fide medical purpose. And again, we have the findings of sexual intent that I've already discussed. And so I think that defeats the bona fide medical purpose argument as well. And the last thing I wanted to briefly respond to was just counsel's argument about the rule of lenity. I cited the case Thonsavon, I don't know if I'm saying that right, in my brief, where the Supreme Court made very clear that the rule of lenity applies, first of all, only when a statute is ambiguous, and even then is essentially a last resort when all the other canons of statutory construction and interpretation have failed to yield a clear answer as to the meaning of a statute that applies criminally. Here, we don't even have a claim that the statute is ambiguous, much less that it's so ambiguous that no other canon can tell us what it means with any clarity. So there is no room for the application of the rule of lenity in this case. And because frankly, the statute is clear, and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, specifically the Hart case, is clear that this is a general intent crime. And I think the argument is clear here that there's, I don't think, any constitutional violation here. So those were the things I wanted to address with regard to the appellant's arguments today. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd be happy to waive the remainder of my time.
I have one question. I'm not sure if my panel judges do, but Judge Freeman made findings of fact on aggravating factors. Two aggravating factors: a position of trust in the zone of privacy, and of course, Mr. Grigsby has argued against those in his brief. Does it matter based on the sentence that was imposed?
It does not matter. Judge Freeman, well, the prosecutor actually, after further consideration, concluded that she didn't believe an upward departure was warranted, and Judge Freeman came to that same conclusion at the time of sentencing, finding that although she did make findings of aggravating factors, that in the facts of this case, those factors were not substantial and compelling such that she should depart from the sentencing guidelines. And there's no indication that those findings played any other role in the sentence here. She denied the appellant's motion for a downward departure based on her acknowledgement, for example, of appellant's ill health, but a conclusion that that also didn't rise to a substantial and compelling factor.
Any so other questions from Judge Frisch?
I'll ask a question. Counsel, one of the arguments that Mr. Grigsby is making is that the state is required to disprove the good faith intention of the defendant in this incident. Do you want to address that?
Yes. What I would say is this, that I think that the bona fide medical exception under 609.348 is, I'd analogize it to something like self-defense probably, where if the defense raises a prima facie case of where that could be found in a jury trial, the judge would probably be required to instruct the jury on it. And there is a model jury instruction on that. I took a look at that. And so in that, if it was raised as a defense, then I think the state would be required to disprove it. If it's not raised as a defense, I don't think the state is required to specifically disprove it. What I would say is that in this case, the court doesn't even need to get to that issue because, again, of the finding of sexual intent, which is supported by the facts I recited earlier in Judge Freeman's order. And it would seem to me that if there is a finding of sexual intent, that there could be no good faith medical reason for the actions because the intent is sexual gratification, not any sort of bona fide medical purpose. If there's no further questions, I'd yield the remainder of my time.
It appears not. Thank you. And we'll turn back to you, Mr. Grigsby.
Thank you. The state is simply reiterating the errors of the trial court as evidence of sufficiency. I have never said the only fact in this case were the arguments essentially that I made. She did make findings, and they are exactly what the state said. 9 years old, didn't need help washing, and the finger moved. Okay, this is consistent with exactly the argument I'm making, that it doesn't have to be that he is accused of not following his wife's instructions, that he was adept at this, that he was adroit, he understood. He may have been silly and ham-handed or inexperienced, but that's why it's only bona fide good faith that's required here. It is not proof of sexual intent that she was nine. It is not proof of sexual intent that she needed no help washing. None of these factors logically negate the good faith activity that he was performing that I've argued. So the point I'm making is that this is an appellate argument. It's not sufficient to say, well, the court made the finding. We're here precisely on whether that finding is sufficient. So then the factors that are cited are not additional acts of sexual intent. That she's nine and touched genitals does not make it more probable he had sexual intent. Let me address the analogy to a self-defense argument. I think the state's close, but just not quite right. It's self-defense, obviously, if it's raised, burden of production, they have to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. But this is the bona fide medical exception is in a superordinating statute. There is nothing in the statute that has to be raised. It simply says CrimSax 1 has no application to this, period. So it would be the burden of the state to have to negate the criteria that the bona fide medical exception requires before there can be application. This is a condition they have to meet. So this is not like self-defense that has developed for a long time out of Anglo-American jurisprudence. This is a specific statute. And the statute, without that statute, virtually every visit to the doctor of for women and men under certain circumstances would be a serious crime, changing a baby's diapers. This is part of the presumption of innocence. It's not something that the defendant has to raise as a burden. And he did, even though he didn't do it specifically, because the testimony is that it was during the course of bathing, moving the finger, it was brief, it moved. It was exactly a mimicry of how you show bathing, or at least that's how he thought. we men don't have a whole lot of experience with another gender's hygiene routines. So I understand the sensitivity of this issue. I understand that no court wants to invite a bunch of new defenses that dispute sexual intent. But without that, there cannot be any warrant for a state interest in convicting people for touching as if it were sexually fraught, where it is not sexually fraught. And that's why this is a novel issue. It hasn't been raised. And I commend that issue to the court for decision. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing on our Zoom platform. The arguments are very helpful to the panel in reaching its considering our responsibilities in this file matter. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe, which is